Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have you all joining us again for another fine episode here. We've got a lot that's been going on since the last time we recorded, including a new Facebook group that we have access to. If you are interested, we can set you up connected with that. But we've also got a great clinical episode tonight. We haven't done a clinical topic in a while, and I think it's about time we jumped back in and picked Dr. Joe's brain, so we'll be doing that a little bit later on. Of course, you know, we can't pick anybody's brain without including Sam in the process, so hey, Sam.
Does that mean I'm a good brain picker? Is that what you'd say? Or I've been picked clean, one or the other, I'm not quite sure. Well, it seems like it's been everybody's been in a travel mode here, just talking to Dr. Joe and our friend Kevin Ryder from Texas, and he's been running around doing travel and training as I have. I just got back from California doing some firefighter training. Jamie, I don't think you've gone anywhere lately, though, have you?
Just took my daughter to college. The youngest went off to college this past weekend, so I was in Youngstown, Ohio. It's about a six-hour drive west of here, so we were there all weekend getting her settled in.
Well, then I guess you were traveling as well. So as we were traveling around the world, what kind of things were going on there? I kind of fell out of the news, except for, of course, the wildfires in California, which is ever-present anywhere you are in California. But you might want to catch us up on what else is going on up there.
Well, I mean, there's you know, a lot going on. I mean, we talked a little bit about some of the flooding in Louisiana that happened in uncharacteristic regions that don't normally flood or areas that don't normally flood. They basically got like 2 feet of rain in one day. And, you know, that's 24 inches of rain, and just it was just astounding the amount of rain that dropped in one location. Basically, a tropical inversion developed right over the coast and just went and sat over the middle of southern Louisiana. One weatherman I looked I was watching said that if it had developed out in the Gulf, it would have turned rapidly into a tropical storm and possibly a hurricane before it made landfall. But it just so happened that the wave developed right on the coastline and quickly went inland. And this is something we've talked about in before, is it doesn't have to be a tropical storm or a Category 4 or 5 hurricane to cause catastrophic damage. It can be a storm with very little winds and just drop torrential amounts of rain, just sucking moisture out of the Gulf and then dumping it inland. And that's what this storm did. They call it a 1,000-year event. So once in a 1,000 years, this type of flood would happen in this region, which is amazing.
What, you know what, Jamie, that reminds me, and this may have been the last time something like this happened, but my very first deployment ever was 1985 when I was working for Red Cross, and it was Hurricane Juan that came in and took out the southern end of Louisiana. And it what it had done then was the hurricane came in and the levees held, but then it went back out, gained steam, sort of what this one sounds like, and then came back in and just flooded everything out. And unfortunately, this was just at the time of year where they had just done all their fishing for their winter stores. And of course, they lost electricity and lost all their food for the winter and everything. And this was a population down there, I mean, the true Cajun population, that weren't used to having outsiders come and help them. But strangely, once they learned we came voluntarily from all of these different places, including California, they had a whole different mindset, and we were very welcome there. So it was quite an experience for my first disaster. But I think how that storm came in and how it ended up flooding out so much of southern Louisiana sounds very similar to this one.
Yeah, it's a big deal, and I think, you know, people talked about how quickly the waters rose, how quickly the water levels came up, that there was very little warning for people to get out, and 13 people died as a result of many of them in vehicles that got swept away. We've talked about that before. Kevin, you're on the call with us. You've told us many times, stay out of moving water.
Exactly. It's just a bad scene.
Well, Kevin, I heard you put I hear you put an interesting video up on the Facebook site too, right? as far as moving water.
We had talked before about flash floods, and I know I had shared some videos that made it up onto the show notes. But if you're told to leave somewhere because there could be a flash flooding, don't wait to see if it actually happens. Get out of there. Because when it happens, it happens. If you look on our new Facebook group page, you'll see that video, and you can time and see how long it takes to actually show up and how fast it moves. And it isn't always how fast it moves, but it's the volume and what it's carrying or pushing that can really get you in trouble.
And the video is very dramatic.
Because of the flash flood.
It carries an entire tree trunk downstream. And the video is only a minute or a little over a minute long. And we watch a dry creek bed fill up with water and overwash the roadway and carry logs and things past the person videotaping it. If you were in there, you would have been swept away. If it was powerful enough to sweep these logs downstream, it was going to carry you too and your car. So it's just another example of why this is so dangerous and why people need to be aware. And then, of course, we've got all the fire incidents going on the West Coast where it's just dry and that's that time of year, and several fire incidents going on. I think I'm looking at the map right now, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 active fires going on in Cal Fire right now.
Oh, yeah, the Blue Fire is kind of the hot topic, and it's the one that's really going crazy. But I just want to throw in, too, Jimmy, we're going to have more conversation with some people that were very intimately involved with the floods in Louisiana starting next week. So if you're interested in what's going on there from the provider point of view, do tune in. Yeah, the fires are, it's just so hard to get them out, and the conditions are so bad. In fact, we've even got a red flag warning right here in Colorado right now, so even that's a little scary. So, yeah, you know, we could have more there could be 2 more months of this in California. It's really, really scary stuff.
So, you know, we'll keep you up to date with what's going on and talk about how it applies to your preparedness, your organization's preparedness. You know, just try to keep the discussion going. I mean, that's what it's all about here is we know you're aware that the flooding happened. We don't think you're living under a rock, but we do want to continue the discussion of why it's pertinent, why it's relevant to think about, all right, what would I do if? What would my family do if I was assigned to respond? Would I be comfortable leaving my family to fend for themselves while I went and took care of my community? And these are questions that every responder in these situations has to ask. So, you know, keep that stuff in mind, and we'll continue to have these discussions.
Well, and Jamie, on that note, I do remember hearing of so many firefighters in California that had their own homes burnt out, but yet they still stayed there, like you said, to help the community. They were aware that their families were safe because they had pre-planned. They had disaster sites, and of course, the folks involved in the fire operation were good about getting people evacuated. But still, can you even imagine what that must be like?
No, it's upsetting, and you know, the same thing's going on. I mean, in these Louisiana communities with the flooding, I mean, these are communities that are supported by, in many cases, volunteer fire departments and maybe volunteer EMS organizations as well, where they are having to rescue their neighbors alongside their own families while they go about the job of being a responder.
Exactly. So even more so than families, responders have to make sure their families are set up and ready to go, so they have less to worry about if they happen to be on duty when something hits.
Yep.
Would you agree, Dr. Joe?
Absolutely. That's part of it. We've actually had one of our incident support teams and the Texas Task Force down in Louisiana working this week.
Wow, yeah, I've heard a little bit about that. I know they've had quite a few federal resources down there. So it doesn't surprise me with something at that magnitude. So we'll see what happens. But, Jamie, we're not hardly finished with the hurricane season yet, are we?
Well, no, absolutely not. In fact, I think the H-named storm is about to be named in the Atlantic Basin, and they'll be sweeping in and coming up towards the Bahamas sometime later this week as we record this on our Tuesday night recording schedule. So I think it's going to be Hermione, I think, is the name of this one. So for all you Harry Potter fans out there.
There you go. Well, switching gears a little bit, Joe, we were kind of tossing around some ideas because, like Jamie said, we haven't done a clinical topic in a while, and maybe we can kind of relate this topic to the flood scenario and the fire scenario and maybe the tornado scenario and whatever else might be in there. But if you wanted to talk a bit about C-spine, and I think the first question that came into my mind was C-spine mindset, research, and training has changed so much in the last few years. How much of that has actually translated into the disaster rank and file?
Well, I you're certainly right. There's been an awful lot of almost a complete shift in our thought process and our approach to managing patients who potentially might have injuries to their spinal column. You know, part of the reason I thought this was worth talking about is that in a mass casualty or disaster situation, things are compounded multiple fold by the idea that if you're going to need to immobilize a patient and sort of do the old school stuff we've always done with a C-collar and backboard and padding and all that sort of stuff, then you have complicated your ability to move that patient out of an austere environment significantly. You know, part of what I thought we ought to talk about tonight was just sort of the ramifications of immobilizing the C-spine as we've always done.
Yeah, and that brings up also the topic that people are trained differently. Some areas will be very much on the cutting edge of less is more. And then you're going to have people that are still in the old tradition within their own team or with other teams that have a very different mindset. It would be interesting to see how that's going to work. But I think what you're saying is it, once we put someone in full C-spine, then we kind of committed them to not only a difficult extrication, but a different level of care. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that's part of it. You know, I think that we've approached immobilization of the spine fairly dogmatically over the last 10 or 15 years, thus the big shift clinically and sort of, you know, more day-to-day EMS toward a process that basically allows us to evaluate the patient and take in some historical physical finding and clinical clues to decide whether or not the patient really is at much risk for a spine injury, especially a significant spine injury. And therefore, you know, on patients that are not, try to reduce the amount of work that we do to them. It's uncomfortable. It causes problems, has its own set of complications related to pressure sores and discomfort and, you know, you name it. There's just a million different issues associated with it. So I think in an austere environment like a disaster, the real issue is going to be in patients that do truly have spinal injury. You really got to think about how often are we going to see those folks. I would submit that if you've got a pretty severe and significant spinal injury of some sort in a disaster scenario, unless you happen to be in a location or environment where help is immediately available, you're not going to do well. If you're trapped in a building and awaiting a significant rescue, then you're just not going to do well at all. And then obviously for someone who isn't trapped in a situation like that, once they are fully immobilized, you have made the extrication of that patient from that environment much more difficult. You can't bend them, you can't twist them. They're on a board. You got a whole bunch of other stuff attached to them. The bulk is much larger, and et cetera. So it really gets to be a very difficult situation and a very difficult evacuation of that patient just because of the amount of resources they're going to require.
Yeah, and I'm visualizing the scenario where you have a rescue team in that environment. You have a helicopter that can pick them up on a board and put them in a Stokes and fly them away. That's very different than when you have to use manpower to get someone out of that environment. Kevin, I think you can speak to that, being the wilderness trainer that you are. First of all, how much do you think that complicates the issue? And secondly, how would you train people to get someone out of there that may need C-spine?
Oh, it definitely compounds it. Just the amount of people needed to care for that patient can quadruple with the addition of a backboard, because if you have somebody with, a broken tib fib, you can walk them out or down the trail or get them out to the road or get them into an area where they can either be transferred to an ambulance or an aircraft with maybe two people. Once you put somebody on a backboard, now you have at least four people. And you're going to need at least eight, because carrying somebody on a backboard down a trailhead, you're going to need to swap those people out about every 5 to 10 minutes, because they're going to get it tired. Plus, now you're introducing the greater potential of the rescuers being injured, because now you're talking carrying a person on a backboard down a trailhead, and a person carrying the backboard can twist an ankle fall because they don't see an obstacle in the path in front of them. So it just complicates it in a lot of different ways. And the people that now you have designated to help that person, you can't use to do anything else because they're dedicated to that one purpose.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
I was saying, plus normally, I mean, I don't carry a backboard. When I go out to do anything or train, I don't use a backboard, because typically, you only see that in your technical rescue scenarios where you have a lot of equipment that's inherent in a technical rescue. If you just pack your first aid bag and go in the wilderness or the mountains or wherever you're going, you're not going to bring a backboard, so you don't even have it to use. If you have a mule that has a Stokes and a backboard, that's great, but that isn't the standard or the norm. That's usually in specialized cases. Or specialized teams.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Jamie?
No, yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, I think, and so for those organizations that are still doing routine backboarding of patients with suspected spinal injuries, and by suspected, I mean, a mechanism might indicate that they could have done something. In a disaster or austere environment situation, you really need to remember that the best way to get anybody out of a situation is if they can do it on their own two feet. And so you need to be really sparing and really do a full assessment, like Joe said, before you determine whether spinal precautions are really necessary. Because like he said, if it's truly a spinal injury and person's already experiencing paralysis or you know, things like that, the outcome is likely to be poor because of the fact that resources aren't available to care for that person.
That's true. And Joe, you know, on that note, why don't you talk a little bit about the kind of assessment that you would like to see in that environment? And also, if you did have someone, say, with, you know, not a huge level of paralysis like Jamie's talking about, or paresthesias, but some concern with some spinal involvement, what kind of spinal motion restriction and what tools would you use in that environment?
Well, so you presented the real crux of the issue, right? As everybody's pointed out tonight, backboard may not be standard issue, certainly not in austere wilderness environments. So I think the first issue is exactly as Jamie very eloquently described there, in that you're going to really need to do a thorough evaluation of that patient to make a decision as to whether or not that's even warranted in the first place. So, you know, knowing whether or not, I think the first thing is establishment of the patient's mental capacity, for lack of a better word. And by that, I mean that they are able to report to you detailed information about what they are feeling or not feeling, or where they're hurting, what happened to them, what's the what's their input on the mechanism of the event, and to ensure that they're not impaired in some sort of way, because your evaluation relies on them being able to tell you, I'm not having paresthesias, I'm not having weakness anywhere. So, you know, that's kind of the first piece of that. And then to move forward with specifically looking for, you know, areas of the spine that may be tender, any evidence that they do have a significant neurological deficit of some sort as part of your evaluation. So, you know, if you come across something like that, or your patient is also head injured or has an altered mental status for whatever reason, then, you know, the real challenge is how am I going to manage to provide some protection of the spinal column while we extricate this patient from that situation? And I think in many cases it's going to fall to sort of whatever tools are at hand. That may be as simple as, you know, making your own litter out of a couple of small saplings and some burlap to lay the person in and attempt to secure them in such a way that they don't move around very much. And I think paying attention to how you move that patient in the first place. But I think we have to realize that the ability to immobilize someone in a situation like that is going to be very unlikely, very difficult, and we're not likely to have the tools there in the first place. So it's going to very much be a do the best you can and pay attention to what's going on. As Kevin pointed out earlier, now you have the challenges of how do you carry that person and how do you lift them and how do you get them out of a difficult wilderness situation, et cetera. Those are huge challenges to not only hurt to not only protect the rescuers, but to make certain that a patient who's on a makeshift device to move them, it doesn't fall off of it in the process, or we lose control of that device and drop them.
Joe, if it seems to me in some of the more recent research about the needless use of spinal mobilization for many cases, that the current understanding is the body does a pretty good job of splinting spinal injury itself without needing the additional immobilization, unless, especially if it's not readily available. Is that true, or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, no, I think you're on target with that. You know, if you look back at sort of the literature for most of this stuff, and there's a large amount of some kinds of literature and a complete lack of others, but, you know, I think in someone whose brain is functioning fairly normally, they are quite good at being able to splint themselves and do a good job of protecting themselves. But obviously that requires them to have the mental ability to be aware of their surroundings and respond to the situation that changes. So I think that's exactly true, and I think that's led a lot to where we are going in our day-to-day EMS, and that we're pulling away from this dogma of everybody gets, you know, a C-collar and taped to a backboard. There have been some really interesting studies looking at extricating patients from a damaged vehicle, for example, and having placed some monitoring type devices on people so that you can utilize some computer imagery to assess how much their spine is moving and things like that, much like you see in motion capture photography and that kind of thing. A lot of really interesting comparisons made between sort of one end of the spectrum of have the patient not do anything. We're going to put a KED on you and put a collar on you and lift you out of the car and all that sort of stuff, to the other end of the spectrum, which is, well, why don't you just get out of the car and try not to move your neck? And interestingly enough, the least amount of spinal motion in many of those circumstances was toward the end of the spectrum of the patient taking care of it themselves, and much less on the side of let us do it all for you. So that's been part of what's driving us away from this dogmatic approach to spinal immobilization and spinal protection. But it does require a patient that can engage and participate in that so that they can take care of themselves.
Joe, another question, and then I'd like to toss this to Kevin, because I'm sure he's got some thoughts on everything we've been talking about. But say you have somebody with some neck strain that's uncomfortable, but they could probably otherwise walk out of there. What kind of things might you have with you, say in a USAR situation, or I'll see what Kevin thinks about in a wilderness austere environment, that you might use for a collar or something to help support their neck?
Kevin, you want to start that one?
Sorry, I couldn't find the mute button. I'm sorry. Say that. I was looking for the mute button. I didn't hear the exact thing. I'm sorry, repeat that question again, please.
Well, what I was asking about, and you heard what Joe was just talking about in terms of, you know, C-spining versus not, but say you had somebody in your type of austere wilderness environment that needed to be walked out and could be walked out because you don't see any paresthesias or numbness or tingling, or that is paresthesias or paralysis certainly, but say they just have some neck strain, what kind of tool could you create to maybe put some kind of ad hoc C-collar together to make them more comfortable?
Sam splint.
Okay.
That's my go-to for a makeshift C-splint. I carry two of them. They're light. They're cheap. They fit anywhere. You can make a pretty decent C-collar with one or two Sam splints. The other thing that you can take into consideration is the environment. Is it a winter environment where the person's wearing a lot of clothing that by its very nature is restrictive already, that you can help use to mitigate unneeded movement? Or are they down here in Texas wearing a T-shirt and a pair of shorts and have virtually nothing to help restrict their motion? So a lot of it is going to depend on the environment, and a lot of it also is going to depend on the rescuers and their level of training and their knowledge about managing these kind of situations in whatever environment it happens to be in.
So in the winter, you're saying if they have a winter scarf, you could probably utilize that in some fashion. Or I was thinking if you had a number of triangular bandages, perhaps, maybe that might provide some sort of support. I don't know. Jamie, you got any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'm just, you know, were I to be in a situation where I needed to immobilize somebody and I didn't have a C-collar, I might consider using a rolled or folded towel or towels, a blanket, something that could give them some, I don't want to say resistance necessarily, but, you know, just something to remind them not to turn their head, and to provide a little bit of limited support. Again, it comes back to, if you've got somebody in this situation, if you're triaging your situation of a collapsed building and you have one patient with a spinal injury, confirmed spinal injury because of assessment, and other patients that can be reached and don't have that injury, you have to make a difficult decision regarding how you're going to triage that patient compared to the other patients, because the amount of, like Joe said, the amount of resources that are going to be required to manage and get that patient extricated compared to what can be done for other patients is significant.
So, Kevin, I'll just throw you another
thing you can do too. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Just to say, another thing that you can do is, a lot of people, when they're out in the outdoors for recreation, lots of times have a tarp with them. I know I bring a tarp with me when I go out. You could also turn that into an impromptu, what we call a Montana horse collar. It's not a true stabilization device, but if you roll it up really tight like a blanket, you can wrap it around their shoulders and their neck to help support their head so they're not moving it, I teach that in one of my classes I teach. But it, again, it's what resources do you have available and how can you use them? And it's all about, I don't like to say thinking outside the box because I don't like to put myself inside the box to begin with, but use what you have and be creative, like you discussed on the previous episodes. But yeah, towels, anything you have, you know, use it if you think you need to and let them help in their own management of their own care.
And you know what you're just describing, Kevin, I do believe I learned that same method when I worked for National Ski Patrol in how you actually use a blanket in a number of ways, but you're incorporating a, you know, some spinal stabilization in it. Well, let's switch gears for a little bit of a second here. And since you're kind of a water puppy there, Kev, so here we are talking about cars floating down, the, you know, people say falling out of cars into the water, and Joe was talking about tree trunks floating down and maybe hitting them. So if we ran into one of these situations in that environment, how would your thinking change?
Again, it's the addition of water complicates everything a hundredfold because there's so many variables and things tend to happen pretty quickly. It would all depend on the situation. You're going to need someone to just watch the patient if they're in the water. So if they go under, you know the last point that they were seen. How fast is the current? What else is in the water? What obstacles are downstream or down in the direction that they might run into themselves or be pushed into or under or through? But you're going to need a lot of resources, and only get in the water if you really have to, because anytime you get in the water, you could be the next victim yourself, regardless of your level of training and your equipment. You know, bad things happen, and they're called accidents for a reason. But it really depends on the situation. If it's a thing like in the video on the Facebook group, if they're in the water, you know, try and, you know, get them to shore somehow, throw a rope, use a limb, get them to shore as fast as you can in as nonviolent a way that you can, meaning you don't want to jerk them or pull them really hard. But you have to, you know, what resources can you use in that moment? Where are they? Who else do you have there? It really depends on a lot of different things. There's no one standard way to do it.
So, Joe, you live in tornado country. How high is the incidence of spinal injuries in that environment? Are people just mostly get extremity injuries and cuts and bruises and so forth, or do you tend to see more serious stuff?
Well, I think you see the whole gamut. You know, thankfully, spinal injuries are relatively uncommon in the big picture of things, except the but they are totally devastating when they do occur. So I don't know that the incidence is higher in those kind of scenarios. I think any sort of disaster situation that involves things falling on you, whether that was from a tornado or an earthquake, you know, a collapsed structure kind of thing, is going to result in a higher percentage of spinal injuries as opposed to, you know, a flood event or a fire event, that sort of stuff. Not that those things can't occur, because you can certainly fall down or be trapped in a vehicle or you know, have your vehicle run off the road or pushed off the road by water, et cetera. But it's really the collapsed structure kind of incident where you're going to see a higher incidence of that.
So I think if we were to, and I'll get your guys' final thoughts on this, but if we were to put this all in a nutshell, it's know what you're doing out there, do a good assessment, make sure your patient is able to give you the right information on what their injuries are, be flexible with the equipment that you do have. And I'd say, since we talked about so many different scenarios, especially reflecting on Kevin's scenario in a flood situation where you don't want to send anybody into the water that hasn't been properly trained, or certainly into a USAR situation where they haven't been trained, that's really the important thing. People shouldn't try to be heroes. They should be properly trained in whatever it is they're doing, so they don't become the next victim. Would you agree, Jamie?
Yeah, and I think that it comes back to, again, having the right discussions, and that's something that, you know, Kevin does with his training, Joe and Paragon definitely do in their training, where they know the discussions to have to open people's minds and thought process up to a different way, a different paradigm of how they think. And that's really one of the keys, I think, to why Paragon makes such a big difference in the response they get from the people they teach at the different events they hold, is really shifting that thought process. And Joe, you guys call it the experience. There are other responses we get from people when we've talked to people coming out of your classes. They just think differently, but by the time they're done working with you guys.
Well, that's certainly what we hope. It is meant to be an experience, and the experience from experienced people. So we believe that word. We believe in that word a lot in every different version that you can use it.
So if folks want to really look at bringing you in, you know, they start examining their jurisdiction, they're looking at their training resources, they are determining what types of events they could expect to have, and they say, Paragon, can you come in and help us out? How can they get a hold of you?
Well, you can certainly find us at our website, which is ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. We've got a presence on Facebook and Twitter with Paragon Med EDU. You can now find us always through the Disaster Podcast website or our brand new Facebook page for the Disaster Podcast.
And we definitely want to thank you again for your continued support of the podcast. And we really believe in what you guys are doing, folks. If you're literally looking for a different type of training experience and training event for your area, you can't go wrong by bringing Paragon in. Start a conversation, find out what it's going to take to bring them into your location. Maybe it's going to take a little while to get it worked out and get the logistics handled, but it's going to be well worth the time and effort, I promise you. So thanks again, Joe.
Our pleasure, always.
Sam, where can folks find you if they want to check out what's going on out there?
Well, I'm going to be hovering around the Facebook site. I've been out of town and I've missed all the good stuff that Kevin's put up there, so I got to catch up with that. On social media, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and certainly on the disaster.com, disasterpodcast.com website. And Kevin, where are we going to find you and out in the wilderness, I expect, and your training?
I will be between Texas and hopefully California pretty soon, doing some more training with a mutual friend of ours. But you can find me at wildsafety.com, and I have links to all of the social media links there, and a phone number and email and all that good stuff. And always on the Disaster Podcast website and new Facebook group.
Yoo-hoo! How about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media channels and sources. And, of course, we're really excited, as you can tell, about our new Facebook group. We've got, 300 and some people on there, 325 members that are in the group. If you want to be part of the group, you have to go there and request to be added. Which is not a big deal. We'll definitely add you, but it really requires you to seek it out, and that means that we have a pretty active and vibrant community over there talking about disaster podcasts or disaster topics. You can just look for Disaster Podcast in Facebook or go to facebook.com/groups/disaster podcast, and you'll be able to find it that way. But look us up over there, and of course, always at disasterpodcast.com, where if you don't want to leave a comment at the Facebook group, you can always leave a comment on any of the episodes over there. And we want to hear from you, so contact us on Facebook, contact us on the website, whatever the case may be. We'll get back in touch with you and forward your questions and comments on to our guests for any particular episode you'd like to discuss.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
So, Sam, you know, we talked about spinal immobilization, a clinical topic tonight, which is great. And really, as we talk about the applications versus a standard night of EMS, maybe rolling up on an MVA and having a motor vehicle accident with somebody potentially needing spinal immobilization versus that disaster situation, they're just two completely different settings.
Two completely different worlds, and it's interesting how things have changed just in the last year in the pre-hospital setting. But then when you equate that to the wilderness or a flood scenario or a tornado scenario, then you have all these other elements to consider. So it just shows us what we've always said: disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.